Your style is unorthodox, but effective. It is not the art, but the combat that you enjoy.
Man, you come right out of a comic book.
You are now listening to Black Comics Chat.
Black Comics Chat.
We are live on Black Comics Chat.
Black Comics Chat.
Black Comics Chat. We are live on Black Comics Chat.
Black Comics Chat. Black Comics Chat.
Shannon, CG, Lauren, and Mel form the Nerds of Prey, a group of ladies bonded by comics, gaming, film, television, and fandom culture. Hang out with them bi-weekly as they dig into the very things that make them loud and proud nerds. Available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play. Also, check out their Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsofprey.
Hi, this is Anthony Rutgazer. I'm the writer of The First Hero and Heroes of Homeroom C, and you are listening to Black Comics Chat.
Hey, y'all. It's Marcus Kwame, and we are back with Black Comics Chat. This episode, we're going to speak to Dr. Sheena Howard and Marcel Dupree. Enjoy.
Hey, what is happening, everyone? What's going on? What's popping? What's cracking? This is Marcus Kwame, and we are back once again with Black Comics Chat. We have a very special interview with a lady whose name I'm sure you're familiar with. We got Dr. Sheena Howard in the house, and she's here to talk about all her exciting new goings on. And we don't have too much time, so we're going to get right into it. How are you doing tonight, Sheena?
I'm awesome. Thank you. And I'm happy to be here.
Okay. Yay.
Yeah, yeah. I think we tried to set something up before and it didn't work out. So
we did. I'm glad it all worked out tonight. Yeah. And of course, before we get into the interview, I have to introduce the Black Comics Chat crew. We got with us, as always, the Carmen Sandiego of the crew, always fresh off her award tour, and a contributor to Dr. Sheena Howard's new Encyclopedia of Black Comics. We got Grace Gibson in the house.
What's going on, good people? And like, I'm super, super hyped for this, as I always am, but even more so because like I got an attachment to this. So yay! So yes, welcome, Sheena. We're glad to have you on. And yeah, good stuff.
Thank you.
Cool. And returning to the show, we got the Quiet Storm himself, the man T Legit. Your boy T Legend is in the house. What's going on?
Hey, what's going on, Black Comic Chat fam? I know I've been MIA. I had to take care of some things, but I'm back in action tonight and ready to, you know, to kick it with Dr. Howard. Been wanting to spit at her for a minute, man, because she's, what she does in her space, man, I think is unparalleled. So I'm definitely want to pick her mind into what we get into tonight.
Yeah, most definitely. So Sheena, Dr. Howard, first up on Black Comics Chat, we always like to speak to our guests about their origin stories. So can you, tell us a little bit about yourself and your origin as far as your involvement in comics?
So my entry point into comics was really graduate school, writing a dissertation on the Boondocks comic strip. And as a kid, I really didn't read comics. And I think, that's part of the story, that I really wasn't introduced to them. I know my brother was into comics. But I think as a young girl, people don't really think to kind of introduce you to comics in the same way that they do young boys. So I was really late to the game and really discovering and entering into this world. And writing about the Boondocks comic strip led me to write that first book, Black Comics, Politics of Race and Representation. And I was just doing it because I felt like there was a void in the academic literature, at least, that addressed the history of, Black comics and the people involved in the comics industry who are of African descent. I wasn't familiar with Eisner Awards or any of that stuff. I wasn't doing it for any sort of award. I was just doing it because I'm like, we need to preserve this part of our culture.
Well, you mentioned, you know, black comics, politics of race and representation. So what was that process like of, you know, putting that book together?
Yeah, so that book, actually, my intent for that book in its original state was to examine comic strips during the civil rights era, because I wanted to know what comics were saying during the civil rights era and how they were pushing back against the status quo. Obviously, if you read the book, it did not go in that direction. And it ended up being really a book that kind of analyzed the comics industry as a whole, looking at race and gender representation, but also looking at cultural gatekeeping for actual artists and creators who are trying to break into the industry.
So I definitely got to point out, like, this is like a staple in my dissertation. Like, this is one of the books that I've been using, like, since day one. And so it's clearly a book that was needed, particularly at the time when it came out. It's like a first of its time, of its kind. So I personally want to say thank you, because it contributes so much to what I do as a scholar that's working on black comics.
Good. So, the aim, because that was when I was writing my dissertation, you know, I went down to Howard University's library. I'm like, I'm going to get a quick book on the history of black comics. And I thought it was going to be quick. And then, like, months later, I'm like, oh, my goodness, like, there's no book that even starts to outline, like, the contributions and the history of, you know, the black comics industry.
Well, I mean, there is now.
In the first chapter and I'll just hold it up. You'll see in the first chapter of this book, my chapter is the history of black comic strips. So I start all the way back from the 1920s. You know, some of the other chapters talk about superheroes and things like that. But my entry point into comics is really the historical, political stuff.
So, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's interesting because it's like, you know, like Grace was mentioning the fact that the blueprint you kind of laid out, despite the lack of material you found at Howard, you know, has really been instrumental to, you know, people like us, because, you know, now fast forward a few years later, you do have a lot of people who are trying to, you know, get the word out about black comics and this wealth of creators that we have. So, mm-hmm. I mean, like, how does it feel to, I guess, really have contributed and, you know, been an early part of that movement?
Yeah, it actually feels good, because, you know, when I was writing my dissertation and just starting to talk about comics in an academic sense, you know, it wasn't much support. You know, that was in around 2007. You know, studying comics from an academic perspective wasn't really seen as, you know, the hot topic to study. Right. So that was a little bit frustrating and discouraging. But now I see that, you know, it is starting to make some headway in the academic space. And I'm really proud that, you know, the academic work that I've done has crossed over to, you know, people who are actually writing and creating comics. And so you see these, like, two worlds coming together and meshing nicely, and each world learning from each other. So that part is probably the best part for me.
Cool. I'm going to use that as a chance to segue, speaking of, you know, bridging the academic work and the comics work. Let's speak a little bit about Superb, which is a book that you're working on with Lion Forge right now. So tell us a little bit about Superb and how it came to be.
Yeah, so I had met some of the movers and shakers at Lion Forge, you know, at one of the comic conventions when I was shopping around my first book. And after I won the Eisner, I know I was really put on the radar in the comics world, outside of the academic world. And so the editor, Joe Illich from Lion Forge, approached me about this idea for Superb. They had a shell of an idea for Superb. The owner of Lion Forge knew that he wanted a superhero with Down syndrome. And so when Joe Illich reached out to me via email and asked me if I would be interested in writing this particular comic book, I immediately said yes. This was the perfect entryway for me into the world of comics as an actual writer, because I get to write a black female lead. I get to write a kid with Down syndrome, which is very obviously, you know, limited as far as representation in media in general. And so it was right up my alley for the background that I had already been coming from, looking at comics from a, you know, cultural critical perspective.
Yeah, yeah. And we've spoken about Superb, you know, a few times on the show, and definitely, like, you know, we've been digging it. I love what you're doing. You know, what's the creative process like between you and you're working on it with David Walker, you know, another favorite of the show, and Ray Anthony Height. So what's the creative flow of the book?
So Ray, the artist, does a great job of really, you know, bringing the whole thing together and really making it look great. So we definitely got a great creative team on the book. And so writing with David Walker, you know, when you have two people writing a comic book, you can probably guess that there are going to be some bumps in the road. Of course, you know, two people, two different ideas. And trying to get into that rhythm and get into that flow of how to work together. So right now, the way we do it is one of us takes a lead on every other book. And you'll notice that with the books that come out, with the issues that come out, sometimes my name will be first and sometimes David Walker's name will be first. And that's because for those issues, that's the person that took the lead for that particular book. And then, you know, we share it with the other person. We have a call, we give our feedback, and then it's, you know, there's a second, third, fourth draft until we come up with something that everybody agrees with and likes.
Okay. And actually, you know, just for the listeners who might not have picked the book up, can you give us a, you know, a quick rundown of what it's about and the premise?
Yes. So I view Superb as really a coming of age story, focusing on two teenagers who are trying to pick the pieces back up after a 9/11 type event. And so it's about their community and what's happened to their community and how the community is trying to rebuild, but also how these teenagers are trying to find where they fit in within this world. And of course, they have superpowers. Of course, it's a superhero story. And of course, Jonah, the lead character, along with Kayla, is dealing with his own personal battles with the Down syndrome. Kayla's dealing with her own personal battles with coming to terms with being someone who's enhanced with superpowers. And one of the things that I do like about this book is that the teenagers talk like teenagers and act like teenagers. You know, that's a big focus for us as writers, that these teenagers actually talk, act, and think like teenagers.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the things that I got from the story. And I know as far as Jonah's character, when we spoke to Joe, I think he had mentioned that you guys also were in touch with people. I think, was it the Down Syndrome Society or?
Yeah, the National Down Syndrome Society. They get to review the scripts that we write too. And I think that gives the book some credibility, and it also puts at least my mind at ease as a writer, because we're representing such a vulnerable population. You want to make sure you get it right, or at least do your research to try to get it right. So having them collaborate with us, I think is really good for the project.
I think that's incredible. Whose idea was that?
It came from, you know, above our heads. We just were told that as writers, we were just told that, you know, we'll be working with the National Down Syndrome Society. So I don't know if Joe reached out to them. I don't know if it was the CEO of the company. But yes, it's definitely a great company to organization to have behind us.
Well, and so I think a lot of writers always hear this, that Odaixian, write what you know. But if you do that, how do you grow as a writer, and how do you challenge yourself, and how do you challenge your reader?
So, yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, and so that you had the fortitude, and it takes some. You got to be humble. You kind of got to humble yourselves to have somebody kind of give you the stamp of approval. Oh. So kind of the, I don't want to say the swelling of ego. I don't think that's the right thing. But the sacrifice you have to make to put the best product out there as a creative, I think right. this is emblematic of that. And kudos to you, because I know a lot of people out there, I don't think they could do it.
Yeah, I actually like the that the National Down Syndrome Society is working with us. You know, they can't tell us, you know, how to write the book. You know, we have final say on what goes in or what goes out. But it definitely is nice to have that relationship.
Could you imagine some major distributors? We're not gonna say their names. When they target a demographic. Actually have people from that demographic right. review their material?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So. That would be great for the medium. And, you know, I worked actually a lot with kids with disabilities in my history. I've actually lived for a year on a campus that was a vocational independence program for students with disabilities. And so I do try to draw on some of those experiences when writing Superb, particularly with Jonah. One of his superpowers is to paralyze people and silence people. And so I really was thinking, like, you know, if I'm a kid with Down syndrome, or I'm a kid that's, you know, different. Kids are mean. Kids will pick with you. So what is one thing that you want to do in your everyday life? You want to shut people up and stop them in their tracks.
Right, right.
So I really tried to put myself in the perspective of a kid like Jonah.
Right. When kids lash out, that's what they be quiet. Stop picking on
yep.
them. That's, yep. Yeah. And again, man, nothing but props here.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, myself, you know, similarly, a lot of the work that I've done has been with people with disabilities, many of them with Down syndrome. And so I'm myself, you know, sensitive to the ways in which, you know, people underestimate and marginalize, you know, that community. And definitely reading your book, I think you guys have done an excellent job of making Jonah a human being, you know, a human being who happens to have Down syndrome.
Right.
And yeah. And
that's what we're going for. You know, a kid that happens to have Down syndrome, you know, we didn't want to normalize him to the point where it's like, oh, he has Down syndrome, but it's not addressed in the book. But we also didn't want to, you know, kind of beat people over the head with it. You know, we wanted to give Jonah some agency as well. So we're... You know, we're trying to play with that balance. And of course, everybody's not going to be 100% happy with the representation. But we have done our due diligence and our research, and we're very cognizant of how we develop Jonah as a character.
So what type of feedback have you received from the public at large?
It's been really, really, really good feedback so far. You know, I've had people tweet me on Twitter with pictures of their kids holding the book. One kid had Down syndrome, and he had the book Superb. He was reading Superb. Nothing but positive feedback so far. And I really like that it's reaching a wide variety of people. You know, I have a fan base on my own that's kind of outside the comics world. And so I think I'm able to bring some people into comics. Not through like the movies and the superhero medium, but through a comic book that's just written well, not a DC or Marvel publisher, but just bringing people into the story who appreciate the writing and the character development.
Yeah, and I think Lion Forge is the perfect place to do that because, yep. You know, like you said, like a lot of people don't realize that comics are more than just superheroes.
Right.
You know, and they have been for a long time. And, you know, I think Lion Forge is definitely a publisher that just in its mission statement, you know, Joe was even telling us about how, you know, a part of the mission of Lion Forge, I think he said Desiree Rodriguez had came up with the idea of the color swatches for people's skin. So essentially a colorist can't come in, you know, down the line and decide to color somebody lighter than how they mm-hmm. were previously represented.
Mm-hmm. So. You know, that's maddening, right?
Right.
And I think, and it's amazing how people that aren't part of a culture could be so blasé about something that is so tied to our identity. Mm-hmm. Right. Because if you go grow up as a dark-skinned kid, there's a certain trauma that you experience as a dark-skinned kid. Same mm-hmm. thing if you grow up high yellow, right? There's a certain trauma that you experience, you know, and not to say one's worse than the other. It's just that it's baggage that you carry.
Right. Well, it's colorism either way, yeah.
Right, yeah. And for you to identify with a character because that character is high yellow with big lips like you or dark-skinned or whatever. Seriously.
I hear you.
But so then they have somebody, systematically change you because they can't find the right stencils. Right. I'm like, come on, dog.
Yeah.
Well, no. That's how people feel when, we change historically white characters to black characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not the same thing, though. But, I will say this.
There's been centuries of white media written by white men.
Yep.
So there's this rich catalog of superheroes that was written when, black people were basically, invisible,
mm-hmm.
Hidden figures. And so to say that we could only be so with that argument, then, you can't use any traditional legacy content. You could only, be black from this point on.
Yeah, right. So, that's true.
And you look at what Ava DuVernay is doing with The Wrinkle in Time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right?
She got the green light from the author's family. And mm-hmm. people are still mad about that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But, the good thing, though, is I feel like the momentum is there and you can't turn it off at this point. So, it's the representation is happening. It's not enough. But, I think that we're changing the dynamic,
Well, right. It's a continuous fight.
It's just like music. If you only turn on the radio and listen to hip hop music on the radio, then you're missing out on a vast array.
You're probably not listening to real. I'm a snob. You're not listening to hip hop. You listen to pop. Right.
So that's where I'm coming from because I'm not a Marvel or DC superhero type person. I'm more of a, who was the first black comic writer and where did it start in the 1920s and what were they doing in the 30s and 40s and 50s? And so then I'm into more of the independent comics like Afrocentric, Kindred by John Jennings, things like that that are not mainstream. And so my world of comics is, diverse.
Right.
And so I think that's important for people to remember too.
Since you mentioned, Afrocentric and John Jennings, both of whom are creators that are featured in your brand new Encyclopedia of Black Comics, let's take a minute to speak about that.
Yeah, actually, John Jennings and Juliana Jewel Smith, who writes Afrocentric, they were actually on the advisory board for the Encyclopedia of Black Comics. So it was John Jennings, Regine Sawyer, Barbara Brandon Croft, Joel Christian Gill. That was my advisory board for the book. And of course they are featured in the book as well. So, this book was a collaborative process. It could not have been done without the many, many, many contributors. It couldn't have been done without, support. Of course, I couldn't write over 100 entries on my own. So this book only exists because of the culture and because of the people in it.
And how long did the process of, putting this book together take?
It actually went quicker than I thought. And that was only because I ended up using a really good publisher. So Fulcrum Books published this book, but I actually started out with another publisher. And as I was going through the process, I dumped them and then found Fulcrum, which was the best decision that I ever made. So I was going to use the publisher for my first book, Black Comics: Politics of Race and Representation, was the publisher that I was going to use for the encyclopedia. So they weren't giving me what I wanted, and I came to a point where I'm like, am I going to be able to find another publisher for this book? If I tell them, I'm not going to work with you anymore. And so it was a really kind of, I took a chance. And I ended up finding Fulcrum, and it was definitely 100% the best choice I made for this book.
Yeah, so I mean, it was a real leap of faith, but it worked.
It really was, because when I told Bloomsbury that, you know, I was going to find somebody else, I actually didn't have another publisher at that time, but I knew they weren't giving me what I wanted. They wanted to make the book like a $150 book that was only available to libraries. And I'm like, no, this book is for like the people.
Right.
I want people to read it. I want people to have access to it. This book is
they
for
the company. They price themselves out their market.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm like, this book is not for the academic industry. It's for the comics industry. I was like, I need a $20 book. I need it to have full color, you know?
I'm an academic, and I'm not about to pay no $100 for that.
So at that price, but not even every library. I mean, libraries' budgets, I mean, times is hard.
Yeah, it would have been a book that nobody bought. Right. And nobody could afford, and it would have been really unfortunate. And it would have been a black and white book with no images.
Yeah.
Oh, God, no.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago, I was doing research for a piece I was writing about Strange Fruit and about Billie Holiday's song. And there was this brilliant documentary that was done. And there was a very limited time that it was available online. So I just happened to catch it when you could see it online. But after that, like, it was gone. And it was something like that where you would have had to pay like $150 to actually like purchase it. So, you know, it's the type of thing where like the people who most need to or want to see these things can't, you know.
And that's the thing too with writing. You know, that's what I really want to impress upon people. You know, you got to. Sometimes you have to go with your intuition and trust your gut. Sometimes, you know what you should do, but it's a little bit scary to do it because you don't have a publisher or you don't know who's going to pick it up. But sometimes you just got to, you know, follow your instincts.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I think that trust in oneself too. And, you know, we've definitely spoken about how, like, for some communities, like specifically ours, specifically for black people, like a lot of times, like the idea of taking a chance isn't something that is supported, you know what I'm saying? Because like we've been taught and shown in so many ways that, like, you know, we don't have as many chances as other people's, but at the same time, like, you know, we do need to have those leaps of faith like you took, because at the end of the day, if we just always believe like I need to go for the sure thing, then yeah, we're never gonna really reach farther.
So, right. Black people don't have a safety net.
They don't. Exactly. They don't.
We don't have to. You know, that's a good point, and that's too. I made a concerted effort with the encyclopedia to include a large number of black women, even if some of the writers and the creators, you know, never wrote a monthly or never published with a publishing company. Some of the women in this book are self-published, but they have their own following. And so that was important to me, because there are women writers out here who've been doing this for years, who are great writers, great creators, great artists, who are not given chances by publishing companies because they haven't wrote a monthly series or something like that. And so I'm really proud of the fact that the book does highlight a lot of women. You know,
well, I would say this, that the published company, they're looking for the next best, whoever the last biggest book was out. Mm-hmm. And so if you're an author and you're coming with something that's just not conventional and something that they can't easily plug into a box, whether it's YA, whether it's woman, this and that, you're going to have a rough time, especially if you're an unknown commodity.
Right.
So the public industry is brutal. And and again, you know, what I just said about cinema, I can repeat. For publishing for people of color and women of color in particular.
But yeah, like a lot of the women in the book, like people like, you know, one of my personal favorites, Micheline Hess, you know, who writes Ovenland, you know, these are brilliant people. And like to your point about not having, you know, written monthlies or work with the big publishers, I think that that's one of the most valuable things that the encyclopedia does is it presents, like, you know, you have her side by side with people like Brian Stelfreeze and people like, Christopher Priest, you know, who have done great work with Marvel and DC. But it's like, it's important that you're putting people like Micheline and Regine and just all these other people like Whit Taylor on the same platform. You know what I'm saying? And not necessarily looking at them as separate or of a different caliber. So,
yep.
You know,
absolutely.
provides a great balance.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. So I know we got to wrap up, but definitely everyone who can hear the sound of our voices, go to Amazon, you know, go wherever you can find it and pick up the Encyclopedia of Black Comics. You know, a lot of the people that happen to be in there, you've heard here on Black Comics Chat. And there's a lot of people who, you know, we have yet to speak to, but I'm looking forward to reaching out to them as well. But it's a truly valuable, you know, documentation of the brilliance that's out there. And it basically, you know, spits in the face of anyone who says, well, we just couldn't find creators of color or black creators. Right. You know,
yeah, so you can't find them if you don't look.
Exactly. Yeah.
There you go.
So, and one last thing, too. You know, I'm hoping that other people, you know, pick up the torch and create, you know, different types of encyclopedias around black comics culture. I'm definitely looking to do, you know, additional volumes in the future. I definitely am interested in people, you know, emailing me and telling me, hey, consider this person for a future volume. People can always email me at blackcomicsbook@gmail.com if there are people that you think should have been in the book that we can consider for future volumes, please reach out to me.
Well, nothing breeds success like success. So I'm sure you'd be hearing, you know, for people that want to be involved in the next volume. So, and we'll do it if we can to spread the word.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Definitely. Dr. Sheena, can you tell the people where they can find you online?
Yes, I'm on Twitter at Dr. Sheena Howard. I have a webpage, SheenaCHoward.com. You can find me. We have a fan page on Facebook, Dr. Sheena Howard. And yeah.
Okay, cool. So everyone, you know, get on your job, get on the internet, get on the computer, and get at her and get yourself a copy of both Encyclopedia Black Comics and Superb. And basically everything else that Dr. Howard is writing.
Yep. Thank you.
One, two, one, two. Hey, hey, what is up? What is happening, people? This is Marcus Kwame, and we are back with Black Comics Chat. You know, this is another very special episode, and we've got a comic creator, a man that runs his own, you know, comic publishing company and, you know, does a lot of really cool stuff. Tonight, we got Marcel Dupree in the house. How are you doing, Marcel?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Cool, cool. Yeah, thank you for joining us on the show. You know, right up top, we always like to ask our guests about their origin story. You know, so can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and how you got into comics, both as a reader and a creator.
All right, I was born and raised in San Diego, California. I started reading comics around the age of 9. My first comic was Evil Ernie. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's like a black and white comic about a homicidal killer.
Okay, yeah. I didn't read it, but I know of it.
Yeah. So I was reading that, read Lady Death, Spawn, The Darkness, Witchblade. Yeah, I stopped reading comics out in the anime and manga. Came back to comics around the age of like 21, reading Vertigo stuff, and then that made me want to try to create my own kind of comics. Did that for like a year or two, took a break, and started back again last year.
Okay, cool. So what, well, speaking of Vertigo, I definitely love Vertigo too. So what were some of your favorite Vertigo books?
Why the Last Man, DMZ.
Oh, yeah.
100 Bullets, Pride of Baghdad.
Okay, so the classics.
Yes.
Yeah, so, all right, that's really cool. So you have, sounds like you have, like, wide-ranging influences, which was my next question. Like, who are some of your influences as a creator?
Big influence is Brian Wood. Like, when I started writing again, I kind of wanted to be Brian Wood. Mm. I, like, copied DMZ with a comic called Brooding. Yeah. So Brian Woods, a major influence. Brian K. Vaughan's influence. Bendis, as far as dialogue, I love his dialogue. Mm-hmm. Miyazaki is a big influence.
Nice, nice. Cool, cool. So you mentioned that, like, Vertigo was big in your, you know, re-entry into comics and as far as influencing you. What was your first step into actually, like, you know, really creating? Like, what was the first book that you created?
The first thing I did was a short story, and I forgot the name of it. I posted it online on digital webbing for feedback, and it got torn to shreds. And I didn't work on anything for a while. I read a bunch of books on how to write, and then I developed Delilah Blast.
Okay.
So, yeah, Delilah Blast is kind of my first comic, official comic.
That's cool. And Delilah Blast, which, you know, we're definitely going to get into in a minute, obviously has been pretty successful so far as like, you know, your successful Kickstarter campaigns. And so, I mean, how does that feel as, you know, having had your first project kind of torn apart to really regroup and put out something successful?
It felt great. I have a lot of credit for that goes to Joe Kodahar, the artist on Delilah Blast. He kind of read my first script and told me what I did wrong from an artist's perspective. Like, he kind of helped me get better at writing comics.
That's cool. That's cool to hear, like, just because, you know, I mean, I think I've, as a medium that, like, is 50-50, you know, visual and written, it's always good when there's, like, a harmony between the written word and the art. So, I mean, it's cool that collaborative, you know, experience really, really helped you grow as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, all right. So, you know, since you mentioned Delilah Blast, let's talk about it. Tell the audience a little bit about the book.
And Delilah Blast is a post-apocalyptic steampunk comic about a girl named Delilah, obviously. Tries to join an organization called the ESA, which is a government, it's a science and military organization that governs the whole world. And at the age of 16, you're able to join. She tries to join, but she's perpetually late, so she misses her entrance exam. And at the entrance exam, she's invited to watch a weather demonstration. And in the weather demonstration, doesn't go well. The weather machine doesn't work. And she figures out a way to fix it. And so she goes on an adventure to get the materials to fix the weather machine, hoping that would get her into the ESA.
Okay, cool. And yeah, you mentioned the artist on the book, and the art is really cool, and I just like the writing and the art are really dope, and I like the this kind of a spirit of fun to the book as well too. Would you say it's you consider it like an all ages book?
Yes, it is all ages. At first, it wasn't, but then I decided. But after like reading Billy Batson and the Magic of Shazam by Art Infranco, I decided that I would want to try to do a kid comic. So I rewrote some of the dialogue to make it more kid friendly.
Cool, cool. I definitely think you achieved that. Like, I think, and you know, that's been a running theme on Black Comics Chat. You know, obviously we've had on all kinds of creators, but we've definitely had, you know, more than a few people who have created all ages comics, which I always appreciate because, you know, as a parent who loves comics, it's always nice to have books that kids can read. Because when you go to the store, you don't necessarily, you know, find a wealth of kids comics. But
yeah,
it's cool that indie creators are really stepping in to fill that void.
Yeah, I think that there should be more all ages comics out there because we need the medium to grow. A lot of the readers are old men.
Right.
And if we don't grow new readers, that medium will die. And I would hate for that to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, that's really smart, too, because I feel like we're in an era where a lot of, you know, people my age that were reading books in the 90s and the 80s are the creators of today. So I think that being able to bridge the gap of the younger generation now, will that's the perfect way to keep the medium going. And I think, you know, it's really dope that people are being forward thinking about that.
Yeah.
So that's cool. So Delilah Blast, yeah, I would say it's definitely notable for just this, the story and the art and just the fun that you bring to it. But I think another thing that's, yeah, and I think another thing that's notable about it, obviously, is that you have a young female protagonist, which, you know, we don't always get in comic books. So I guess Delilah as a character, how did she come to you originally?
A Britney Spears song.
Oh, really?
Honestly. Yeah. I was walking my dog one day and Britney Spears Do Something came on on my podcast that was on Shuffle.
Right.
And, I mean, my iPod, it was on Shuffle. And I liked the personality in that song that she's exhibiting. So I was like, okay, I like this personality. I kind of have an idea for a character. I don't have a story yet. And so during the walk, Toxicity by System of a Down came on. And that kind of merged the character with the story and made it all work.
Okay, cool. I mean, hopefully Britney Spears doesn't hear this and try to come after you for like royalties or anything, but you know, I think it'll be all good. So Delilah Blast is really dope, and I guess we should say that, you know, you're definitely working on the continuation of the series, which we'll definitely be speaking about to you about soon. But is there anything that you can, you know, tell the audience about the second book right now?
It is done. We actually have 3 issues done.
Okay.
So the second issue is basically continuing her adventure into space. It has more action and more of her crazy antics. You can see her and Jimbo back and forth a little bit more. I kind of like the dynamic with her and Jimbo. And we get to see why Tiki is considered her bodyguard.
Okay, cool. So, I mean, it's going to be really dope to see that grow. And we'll definitely, you know, help push when the next Kickstarter launches. And I guess while we're on the subject of Kickstarter, you've had, you just wrapped another successful Kickstarter, but it seems like you've really, you know, got a good thing going with crowdfunding. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And I guess tell the audience what your keys to success are without giving it all away.
Basically, just getting the word out, making sure you have good art, connecting with the right people. Yeah, basically, that's all I do is just connect with the right people and have great art. Yeah. Using Twitter, Facebook, social media. That'd be very active on social media.
Right. Cool. And I know a lot of other people we've spoken to about Kickstarter have mentioned that they've kind of gotten the ball rolling as far as promotion is concerned, like well ahead of the campaign. Like, is that something that you do as well?
With Delilah Blast, I started promoting 3 months before I launched the Kickstarter. With POM, I did not promote ahead of time. I basically promoted it like for 2 weeks ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I dropped it and it ended up being pretty successful. But the difference is with POM, I did that with Powerverse, which is ran by Vince White.
Right.
And he kind of was a driving force in the promotion of that, but he also didn't promote it to the day it dropped.
Okay. Well, yeah, I was going to get to POM in a little bit. But yeah, let's talk about it now. Because, you know, we spoke to Vince in, I think it was episode 49. He told us all about the Powerverse, and I think it's a really, you know, a really dope idea. So how did that collaboration come about, and how does your story and your characters figure into the, you know, the larger Powerverse?
Basically, we start talking because I congratulated him on his Willpower Kickstarter, because it ran during the same time as Delilah. So I just hit him up to say congratulations. We started talking about our process and comics, and he asked me, he said that the door is always open to come to Powerverse if I wanted to. And Joel and I kind of had POM just laying around. We weren't doing anything with it. So I asked Vince if he thought it would be cool. He read it and liked it. And we're trying to make it fit in. because I'm way ahead with that book as well. Like, we're like 4 issues in.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, we're trying to retroactively fit it in.
Okay.
With the Powerverse thing.
Yeah.
Which it kind of really doesn't right now. It's kind of off on its own, to be honest.
Right. Well, the cool thing, I guess I should mention for listeners who maybe didn't listen to episode 49, just a real quick, and, you know, you can definitely add to this, being that you're part of the Powerverse and you probably have even more information than me, but the Powerverse is, was created by Vince White, and it's a big, cool, shared universe / collaboration where, you know, various creators can kind of bring their properties and their characters to this shared universe, but also retain, you know, the rights to their stories, and they can still go off and tell whatever stories they want. My understanding about it when we spoke to Vince was definitely that it's something that where you can, you kind of have the option of how much you overlap with the other stories or not.
Yeah. It's basically a multiverse. Like, instead of DC Comics in the 52,
right,
Powerverse is basically like that, but with unlimited worlds.
Okay,
and
cool.
Each creator is basically off on their own world. It's encouraged that you kind of branch into the world as a whole, but you don't have to. And I kind of choose not to.
Yeah, I hear that. That makes sense. But yeah, I should say Grace just joined us on the call. How you doing, Grace?
I'm good. How are you all doing?
Okay.
Doing well, thank you.
Very good. Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. You know, fresh off the war tour, as Marcus likes to say.
Yes. Yeah, I know it felt kind of strange, you know, doing a cold open without doing all my introductions. So, you know, I'll do it right now, man. We've got returning to the show the Carmen San Diego of the crew, fresh off her award tour. We got Grace.
What's going on? Yes, I'm glad that I was able to come in. I'm literally just getting off the road in Providence, Rhode Island. So, I was like, I got to jump on if I can. So I'm glad that I can. So, yes.
Yeah, well, we definitely appreciate you making it. And also adding legitimacy to the Carmen San Diego, moniker.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, we were just speaking about POM and about... you know, the recent, most recent Kickstarter success out of many that Marcellus had. I guess since we touched on POM, can you, Marcel, can you tell the audience a little bit about that book and mm-hmm. what it's about?
Okay. That book's about a character named Brittany Armstrong. She's the daughter of the world's most famous superhero, but she doesn't want, and she inherited her dad's power, all of her dad's powers, but doesn't really get the idea of having the responsibility of it. So she just wants to party, have fun, and use her fame just to live a lavish lifestyle. But all of that gets put into jeopardy when her father suddenly has to leave Earth, so someone has to step up and take his place in the company, which is a licensing firm based on him being a superhero. He licenses his image to make money. So she has to step up and take his place by trying to be a superhero.
Nice.
Yeah. It was really cool, and I think one of the things I enjoyed about it was that, you know, I mean, superheroes have been around for a long time, and it's like, you know, a lot of stories have been told and maybe retold, and even repackaged. And I feel like this was I'm always interested in kind of new takes that people can, you know, add to the superhero mythology in kind of new ways, because, you know, when you get with the larger companies, they have, you know, their properties and their like big money, you know what I'm saying? So like, there's only so far that they're willing to venture outside of the established formula. But I think that, I really like seeing people play around with the whole idea of superheroes. And so I thought that was something really cool about the book and the approach you took.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Cool. Yeah, and I mean, even from that particular storyline, it seems as though, like, the storylines get extended more than what we, like, find in, like, the big two or in, like, Marvel and DC. So I feel like they get, from what I was reading, like, it gets expanded more. And so I don't feel like I get cheated or feel like it's only giving me half of what could be there. So definitely gives like a full body storyline versus like a just a reduced one, you know, enough to just grab you. But this grabs you and keeps you going. So
thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So how long do you have this series planned for? Like, is it a limited series, or are you planning to have it ongoing?
I'm doing the Dark Horse approach with a series of miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
So the first series is 5 issues. We're going to do like a 2-issue anthology to like give Joel time to work on the second series, because he draws POM and he draws the Light of Blast. So in order to make both of them work, we have to like have separate art, have guest artists come in. So we're going to do, he's going to do 5 issues, and we're going to have a two-issue anthology type series, come back with the next series in the fall of next year.
That's cool. That's really smart, go ahead. I'm sorry.
We have the story goes on for about 60 issues total. Mm-hmm. But since we're doing a series of miniseries, if people don't like it, we can stop any time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Cool. I find that to be effective too. Having like I like that Dark Horse approach as well. As I feel like that's much more effective and keeps the story going. And like you said, at any point you really could be like, okay, we're gonna close it out or finish it here. So yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and then also just as indie creators too. I mean, definitely speaking from an artist's perspective, I think it gives the creators time to breathe and really make mm-hmm. creative quality material. Because it is a lot of work to put out a comic book. So I think that approach really helps keep the quality up as well.
I agree.
Cool.
Totally agree.
So so let's talk about Armor. We haven't talked about Armor yet. Can you tell us about that series?
That series is about intergalactic war that is brought onto Earth when scientists who create the universe's most dangerous weapon crash lands on Earth trying to hide the weapon from the two empires. And it ends up in the hands of a 16-year-old boy named Jason. And Jason's task is trying to keep the weapon safe, which doesn't really work out that well for him.
Cool.
It's kind of, yeah.
Yeah. Much like with the Delilah Blast, so I was saying about kind of the spirit of fun in the book, I definitely mm-hmm. got that from this book as well. I mean, it seems like you also wanted it to be something that could be read by all ages, by multiple ages, right?
Just about to say that same thing too, yeah.
Yeah.
That was the goal with that, is to make it all ages from the start. As soon as I started that, I sat down with Carlos Trigo, the artist, and I was like, I want to do the sci-fi book, and I want to make it sure it's all ages. I love your art. How do you feel about doing it? I told him the whole story. He said he enjoyed it, and we started developing that immediately.
Cool.
We're currently on the last issue of the series right now.
Okay.
And it seems like with all three, or, at least what we've been talking about so far, like there's also a youthful approach that hasn't really been like a big focus, or like all of a sudden now a lot of creators or comics are pulling out like not adult, main characters. And so I think that goes to the whole all ages factor, and seeing I appreciate that as well, because like half the time we're always seeing like adult characters and them being adult superheroes. But like seeing someone who's like a teenager, we see like, superheroes can be any age, right, and not necessarily just one designated type. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point, Grace. I mean, actually, when you mentioned that, what it made me think of is the fact that it's really effective, because in a lot of ways, I mean, I think even those of us who are adults, we can relate. We remember being that age, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it works on that level. But obviously for a young reader who happens to actually be, a kid or around that age, they can really see themselves in the story as well. So I know for myself, like when I was in high school, that was when, Milestone was big. And,
right.
Like Static, I loved all the books, but like Static was my favorite book, because like he was the same age I was at the time, you know what I mean? He even kind of looked like me. So, I just really dug it, because I felt like I was literally seeing myself in the comics. So
exactly. Right. And it's like kids don't have to wait to, you know, read these comics either, because, like, most of the time, a lot of the comics were for adults, so, like, a kid couldn't read it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Speaking of Static is a major influence for Armor One. I grew up with the Static Shock cartoon. Mm. Wasn't familiar with the comic at all. When I sat down to create Armor, I had that in mind. I actually kind of, like, one of the characters in there is a homage to Dwayne McDuffie.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Jason's Coach McDuffie.
Yes. That's really cool. That's really cool. Yeah. I mean, like, Static was really groundbreaking. I was really happy to see it, you know, kind of getting that larger audience through the animated series. Because, you know, I mean, I really dug it. I mean, I had issue one. It was one of my cherished comic book possessions.
Mm-hmm. You Me know. Too.
Yeah. But it was just cool to see that, like, it blew up. And now, yeah, I meet people who grew up on that cartoon, and it's really nice to see. And yeah, Dwayne McDuffie, man. Like, we've spoken about him so much on the show, but he's really just been a huge influence to so many people. And I mean, it's a shame that he's not still here creating and just adding even more. But he gave us so much while he was here.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he was truly ahead of his time.
I'm not really familiar with his comic work. I'm more familiar with his animation work.
Mm-hmm.
I love his work on Static and Justice League.
Justice League, yeah.
Really influenced me.
Yeah. And didn't he, Ben 10 too, right? Wasn't he involved?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
He did some Ben 10. I didn't really watch Ben 10. That was more like my little brother who liked Ben 10.
Yeah. I mean, I'm well out of the target audience too for that, but... Well, that means, but I do know, because I teach art, and, like, a lot of my students, you know, are big Ben 10 fans, so I kind of know about it through that. So it's been cool though. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all right, cool. So tell us a little bit about just more about the future, you know, of your I don't even think we mentioned the name of your comic company. What's your comic company called?
Evolutione Publishing. It's Italian for evolution. Evolution was taken already, so I went with the Italian version of it.
That's cool. It's classy. Mm-hmm. It's classy, yep. And you know, it's international. Mm-hmm. I like it. Cool. So yeah. So what do you have? What are your plans for the future for the company?
We're basically, it's a creator-owned company. Well, there's two branches. There's Evolutione Publishing and it's SOT Comics. Evolutione Publishing focuses on creator-owned and creator participation comics, where the creators have the freedom to basically do whatever they want, have fun, be creative as you want. And we just hope to expand the medium by looking at things in a different way with great art. And then we have SFC Comics, which is kind of a superhero line, not really a superhero line, but it's from our SFC wrestling comic. It expands from there, which is basically wrestling with superpowers.
Okay.
And the other comics from there are just the wrestlers' lives outside of wrestling. So we, in like July, we did a Kickstarter for the first spinoff book, which is Angelica Reigns, written by Brian Hawkins, with art by Federico Sabatini. I can't pronounce his name, it's Italian. With colors by Chiara Marriott and letters by Brent Fowler. That Kickstarter was successful. We're going to ship the book at the end of the month. And we're going to continue with Angelica Reigns. The next year we have Kasai by Madeline. I forgot her last name. I'm so sorry, Madeline.
Is it?
But she writes
Boston Metaphysical?
Yeah, it's Boston and Madeline.
Okay, yeah, that's Madeline Holly Rosing, right?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Thank you. With art by Alessandro Maricolo. And then after that finishes up, we have The Gentleman, written by Greg Anderson Ely. Is Nana the Were-Spider?
Okay.
Yeah. He's actually a good creator for you guys to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
If you guys want to talk to him,
yeah.
We have a book with him. We have a book with him coming out, and then we have a bunch of old material I have had just laying around, a book called Chase, which was created by me with art by Simone. I cannot pronounce his last name, but he's the artist on that new champion, on that new Hulk and Thor book that Marvel just announced.
Oh, okay.
He's art. I did his first published work years ago. I was the first person he ever worked with. So we're putting that out next year. Nice. And I also have stuff like other publishers. I have a book of Action Lab coming out called Deal Breaker.
Cool. And you're writing on that book?
Yes, I'm writing on that book. With a writing partner, Joshua Metzger, with art by Jonas Scarf. Jonas is currently working with Boom on Planet of the Apes books.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
I discovered him when he was like his last year of art school. So like before Boom found him. So I got him to like do a whole book with me.
Wow. So you guys got a lot going on.
Yes.
Cool. And yeah, I you definitely mentioned Kickstarter a few times. So it seems like this crowd is, would you say crowdfunding is kind of like the primary way that you're funding a lot of these, most of your projects?
It's for SFC, yes. Evolutione, the material has been done forever. We're just using Kickstarter as a marketing tool.
Okay.
To like make the audience aware of the books.
You know what it makes me think about, like, and you mentioned Madeline earlier, and I know that as someone where she's put out a lot of successful crowdfunding stuff, she's also kind of like consulted with people or like gives advice, you know, for crowdfunding, and that's also, you know, kind of like a business thing. That's a possibility. So I don't know if that's something you've ever done or you'd be interested in, but I know there's creators everywhere that are looking to figure out how to, you know, find success through crowdfunding.
I'm not confident enough in my crowdfunding skills yet to even think about that. Like, yeah. I credit a lot of the Lila Blast success to Madeline, because her and I did a crossover pinup where if you backed her Kickstarter and my Kickstarter, you got a pinup.
Okay.
That brought a lot of eyes to the Lila Blast. So once I get more confident in it, kind of figure out what I'm doing, I might think about doing that.
Well, you got a lot going on anyway, so I.
Yeah, I do.
But it's cool though. I mean, like, definitely props on your success, because I think that you know, like, crowdfunding really is cool, because it levels the playing field. You know, we've said it before, but it really allows indie creators, you know, to find a way in the door without having to jump through all the conventional hoops where there's only but so many spaces for people anyway. You know,
exactly. It gives that control back to them. Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Absolutely. And you're right. Yeah, the I would say also the promotional aspect of it is really, really cool as well.
Yeah, with the promotional aspect, I've been able to get some of my favorite artists to work with me on doing covers because they saw the Kickstarter. So when I approached them, I was like, mind doing a cover for this character? They did it, no problem. Like, Lila Blast has a variant cover by Marguerite Sauvage.
She's good.
She's amazing. Yeah,
she did the cover for a variant cover for issue one. We're hoping to get her back to do another cover for issue three. Jen Bartel did a cover for issue two. Okay. I don't know if you're familiar with Jen Bartel. And I got Michael Huddleston to do a variant cover for POM.
Nice. Cool. Yeah. Wow. So yeah, man. That's I'm sorry, what were you saying, Grace?
Oh no, I was saying a nice mix there.
Yeah. You got a lot of talent, and that's really cool. You got the connections. So, you know, we're gonna wrap soon, but before we go, this is a new question to Black Comics Chat that we've introduced just a couple episodes ago, but it's an important one. You know, we're talking about how this can be a litmus test for people, for creators. So my question is, like, who is your favorite Transformer and why?
Oh man, I'm not familiar with Transformers at all.
Okay, that's okay. I actually had a backup question just in case. So, So if
I feel like, wait, Transformers and Beast Wars are the same thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. It could be any generation of Transformers. It doesn't have to be the old original Transformers.
Okay, it's the cheetah from Beast Wars.
Okay,
the cheetah from Beast Wars. He was cool. Okay, yeah.
Cool. All right, so it's like an aesthetic style thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, definitely. I mean, I think with Transformers, like whatever generation of Transformers, it's always the one that you thought looked the coolest anyway. So,
right.
Yeah. Wait, Grace, I forgot. That one, did we?
Yes, we Bumblebee. Thought,
oh, Bumblebee. That's right. You're a Bumblebee fan. Yeah. I'm sorry. What were you saying, Marcel?
With Beast Wars, it wasn't something that I was into. My stepdad, who's a huge Transformers fan, kind of was hogging the TV, tried to sit down and watch it with him on Saturday mornings.
Okay, so that's kind of how you got introduced to it.
Yeah, that's kind of how I got into it.
Okay, cool. All right, well, my backup question, you know, just you know, since Transformers weren't your main thing, is just like, who's your favorite villain of all time in comic books? And why?
That's a good one, too. I got to think about that. I got one that comes to mind.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely want to hear yours, too, after Chris. Oh, sorry.
I want to immediately say Joker.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's very unpredictable. And I like the dynamic between him and Batman. It's kind of like a romance that they have. It's an unspoken love for each other.
Right.
In a weird way.
Yeah.
So I'll go with Joker.
Okay. That's always a good pick. Definitely.
Yeah.
What about you, Grace?
Yeah, actually, you know, as I think about it and listen to Marcel, I would say Joker for DC. And although he could be seen as an anti-hero or a villain, Magneto, it was something about I agree, you know, especially like the filmic versions of him. I'm like, you know, I feel you, Magneto. Like, right. They don't get you. I get it. You know, so like his villainy draws me into be like, you know what? Like, if I could be a bad guy, I want to be him.
Right.
So. Yeah, I'd say probably those two. And then, the Joker, because he's, this clown, I think people, you know, in clown in the sense of, makeup and so forth, I think people underestimate him for that. And so, but, his villainry is probably, you know what, I'm scared of that. If Magneto, I'm not so much scared of, but, the Joker, I'm scared of him. So, yeah, those would be probably my two.
Yeah, no, those are great choices. Honestly, that's pretty much my choices as well. Magneto, it's the fact that obviously, you know, you can see his point of view, you know, from a logical survival standpoint, you can see his point of view. And I think that relatability is what makes him really cool. The Joker, you know what I'm saying? I can't relate to him, but definitely just the chaos that he brings. And I think it's really interesting, how long, he's been around since the 40s, but but writers just for decades have been able to kind of do new things with that blueprint that was made back then. So, just the way they've explored the relationship between him and Batman is really cool. I mean, right up until today, honestly, there's some really cool stuff going on with that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I can't relate with him, but I appreciate the reinventions of him. And in a way, I feel like how he has evolved has strengthened who he is. Cause in the early, you said in the '40s, I'm I don't know.
he was psychotic back then too, though.
He was, but you know, I guess it was more, it seems more dangerous now.
Right. Yeah. I got you. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So that's what's up. I guess we'll end on that villainous note. But we'll definitely be speaking to you, you know, soon, Marcel, when, you know, you return with the Delilah Blast, Kickstarter, you know?
All right. Awesome.
Cool,
thank
man.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us. And, it's, cool. Let people know where they can find you online and where they can get by your books. Most importantly,
you can find, my books, on Comixology or on Indie Planet. You can find me online, Twitter, @Marcel_Dupree, Facebook, Marcel Dupree, or Evolutionary Publishing. You can find all information about Evolutionary Publishing at evolutionarypublishing.com.
Marcel, can you spell that just for people who aren't familiar with spelling?
It is EVOLUZIONE. Evolutione.
Cool. International.
Yes.
That's what's up. All right. Cool. So you heard it here, people. Definitely check out Evolutione. I hope I said that correctly.
Yes, you did.
Dope. And Grace, you got any last words for the people?
Nope. I'm a loss of words today. For one time here. But just definitely check out Marcel's work. Definitely, be on the lookout for more, because I definitely, really appreciated and enjoyed it. So I for sure will be on the lookout as well. So I just send out that recommendation to everybody too.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Black Comics Chat.